podcast on Germany. My name is Jacob, and this is episode 43, Building the Frontier of an Empire. I hope everyone has had a great November. We are in the last month of this year. Just a reminder, with this Christmas season coming up, if you're looking for gifts, we have a wonderful design in our store that can be put on t-shirts, mugs, and virtually anything else. You can go to our website and find the store page there. Okay, so back to our storyline. Last we talked, Arminius, Germanicus, and Maroboduus were dead. The year is now 37 AD, and we have worked through the Gallic campaigns of Julius Caesar since the 50s BC, where the German tribes and the Romans were fighting over dominance in East Gaul, to now establishing the Roman border along the Rhine. This history was at times sketchy, but we were still able to piece together a coherent story. Well, now the story is going to collapse for the next several years. Actually, next several centuries. Our source material gets rather weak as we move forward, and we can't pull much for a steady timeline. We can't tell you what happens year after year after year, or even decade after decade after decade. What sources we've been using were rewritten or collected and gathered and republished later on in the Roman Empire. But now the sources that we're going to rely on are few and far in between. We have Tacitus, who we relied on quite a bit when we were discussing about the latter half of the war with Arminius. But Tacitus has some issues. First of all, he's writing in the late 1st century AD, so he's writing about events that happened in the past for him. He wasn't a witness to these events. The other issue is that he has a clear agenda that he's trying to show the Romans how decadent their empire is compared to the pure life of the Germans. That the Romans were going to have all these issues that the Germans were never going to have due to their basic lifestyle. And Tacitus presents these Germans in this rose-tinted scope through the entire book that he writes about them and excuses the truth. It makes our ability to rely on him as a credible source extremely negligible. While his works on Britain and the internal Rome workings are decent, most historians agree that Germania, in Tacitus's writing, needs to be taken with a grain of salt. Probably more of a whole shaker's worth of salt, but still, not trusted at all. Now, there is one work that Tacitus mentions that historians would kill to have. This would be Pliny's History of the German Wars, which was a collection of about 20 books written around 50 AD. This was supposedly a collection of merchant generals and soldiers' memories and stories of the war with the Germans, and his own research to show the first interactions of the Romans and Germans all the way to his present day. However, it was 20 books, so his work wasn't that popular. It's just too much to get through. Meanwhile, Tacitus, he had written in less detail, took up less pages, presented a more enjoyable story for mainstream audiences. And eventually, Pliny's work was lost to us. He's only mentioned in Tacitus and others' writings, and that's all we know about it. It is extremely annoying to know that this treasure is lost to us, that we could have learned so much more about Germania and the frontier had these books survived. Now, Tacitus only writes to a certain point. He actually doesn't really discuss his own modern time. Or what he does discuss is clearly counterfactual in order to get his point across. After his work, there's not much in description of what is going on the other side of the Rhine. At least not until the end of the Roman Empire, at which point the Germans are no longer being held back by the Rhine. We're talking about centuries of nothing, of just basic tidbits being thrown at us, of, hey, yes, we crossed the Rhine for a little bit, we came back. There's a war going on over the Danube, it doesn't matter. The few works that we have are just filled with errors, such as Ptolemy's geography, which was written around the 2nd century. He relied on 1st century sources, and he was mainly just listing places and geographical features of Germania. Problem was, is that he wasn't very good at it. The few times he does talk about the tribes and their relationship with Rome, it's not very clear in his books what exactly he's getting at. Meanwhile, many of the things that he is trying to get across with his book about geography are clearly wrong because he misplaces tribes and geographical markings throughout the entire area. This is partly because he's located in Alexandria, which is nowhere near Germania. Sadly, it's one of our best sources for the next 2 centuries in Germany. So, yeah, that's the status of our source material. That's why we are only going to be taking 2 episodes, this one and the next one, to cover everything that happens between the death of Arminius to the beginning of the end of the Roman Empire and the crossing of the Rhine. Now, you may be wondering, okay, why are there so few sources? Romans didn't just stop writing. And that's true. We have a lot of information from the Romans. They provide us with a lot of information about their own empire. Problem was, is that Germany was not in the empire. It was also not that important to the empire. It was a minor border for them. The empire was the superpower, which had only really one threat that came from the outside. And they saw this threat over in the east, not in the north. And they truly believed that this was the only threat that could be an equal to them. They definitely didn't care or were worried about a collection of poor and technologically inferior tribes to the north. So the writings, the stories coming from the north just weren't that important. They weren't that eye-grabbing as the stories about their own emperors, about the stories about the rebellions in the east, about the civil wars starting to spark. Who cares what's going on across the Rhine when so many good stuff is happening in your own home? Now, this doesn't just affect the writing. It also affects the relationship with the Germans. The Romans would treat the Germans as inferiors. And the Germans would be expected to give more than what they got from the Romans, or at least more in the Romans' eyes. For the government, for the people, the front that forms between the Germans and the Romans for the next several hundred years is rather stagnant and unimportant. And so their going-ons, their changes, their lives of these Germans, they're unimportant to the Romans, so why write about them? So for us, modern day, the history just completely collapses. We don't know what happens. We don't know what's going on. All we get are a few mentions from the few excursions across the Rhine and the Danube. And between the two, the Danube by far gets more mention. So for this episode, we're going to be looking at the archaeology and the artifacts rather than the written history. See if we can form a better picture of the changes that Germany is going to go through, that the frontier between the Germans and Romans are going to go through. So, now that we've discussed why we're only doing 2 episodes, why the Romans have given us so few sources, let's talk about this new frontier, this new border that's being established from the Roman side. The first thing that I need to say is that the Rhine, what I've been talking about as the border between Rome and Germany, what we always think of when we think of the northern border, was not a planned border. It was not planned to be the northern boundary for the Roman Empire. It was selected as something of convenience. The very first time the Romans began to fortify the Rhine is under Julius Caesar. But as you saw, those weren't much in defenses. He basically just put some garrisons right next to a bridge he built so he could go across the Rhine and attack the Germans if they ever started raiding into Gaul again. Next came Augustus, and he actually establishes some forts in the area, some permanent settlements. But again, these weren't planned to be permanent in the style of this is as far as we go and no further. These were simply staging grounds. This is areas for Drusus to gather supplies in order to march into Germania to explore, push the Roman Empire even further. It wasn't made thinking, yes, this is where we're stopping. This is it. Even later on with the disasters in the Germanic provinces after the rise of Arminius, the Romans did very little in establishing a strong permanent border guard on the Rhine. They do build up some of the defenses. They do put a lot of manpower in the area. But again, it's simply to hold off the current threat and then push again. Get across the Rhine, retake what was lost. Now that the Rhine has been selected by Tiberius, that the Romans will not cross again, even then, it's not seen as permanent. And it won't be permanent. The Romans do cross the Rhine once more. They will establish defenses on the far side of the Rhine. Even with this, though, even with Tiberius saying, we stop here at the Rhine, the defenses don't immediately build up overnight into a super mega fortress. There is not like strands of towers and forts all the way from the Atlantic down to the Alps. It's not like that. Instead, the Romans build up slowly. They take their time. They don't pour too much effort, too much money into it at once. In the beginning, there'll be small fortlets. Not actual forts, just small fortlets. Areas where a garrison could stay at the night and be safe. And these would lay near the river, containing a couple of men just to keep a lookout. These fortlets would all be connected to certain forts located further back into Gaul itself, where the main garrison would stay. And so if one of these fortlets were attacked, then the fort could mobilize and go to that point of invasion. Eventually, around the early 100s, these fortlets would start to change. Some of them would actually be turned into small forts, and they would have permanent garrisons, as the Romans started to realize that they weren't going to be advancing too far. However, as these forts are starting to be improved upon, they do make a slight push, pushing out into Man and Neckar valleys in order to link up this small triangle of land, securing their central northern line from the Danube over to the Rhine. Eventually, 20 years later, the Romans decide to add a few more forts. This is during the reign of Hadrian. And we believe he did this after visiting the area and deciding that defenses needed to be beefed up a little bit. But these forts weren't made of stone. They weren't permanent structures made to withstand sieges. These new forts were basically wooden palisade walls. Maybe with a ditch. Maybe. And they served more as a reminder of Rome's might than an actual physical representation of it. These forts were nothing. They would have been laughed at by Roman citizens who had seen actual forts in the east. The final move for this frontier would happen 30 years later, when it would be moved forward just about 30 kilometers north. And the forts would be slightly improved, as we see a series of earthworks added to a lot of these palisades. Again, around this time. Think about that. They're pushing very slowly, and when they push, it's not much. They take a small chunk of land, simply to secure their boundary, and then they move it forward just a little bit further, just a little bit more. Their defenses are laughable by our standards. This is the Roman frontier. This is their defense against the threat of the north. Now, you may be wondering, okay, what about stone walls? When do those come in? Well, some of these forts will eventually get stone walls when they decided to be permanent structures. But they're replacing the old wooden forts. And this doesn't happen until about the mid-3rd century. 200 years after Tiberius has given up on Germania. So, we do have some changes. Mainly about 100 years after Tiberius has said enough. But it's very minimal, and eventually it stagnates. The Romans don't push up any further. The changes that are made in the 100 years before it stagnates are just improvements of territory rather than actual security or defenses. The Romans push up from the Rhine to establish a stronger barrier between them and the Germans, and also to secure their control of the Alps. It makes it easier for them to keep an eye on the Germans without having to stay within the mountain range. That's understandable. The Roman Republic did that before. But now, they're not really doing much in defense. Now, we talked about a little bit why we didn't see too many stone forts in a previous episode, but just as a reminder, stone was extremely expensive to be set up in Germania. With the frontier as fluid as it was supposed to be in the first and second century, there would be no need to set up a stone fort. It was just much easier to use what was around you, wood. Another reason why the Romans decided not to build these stone forts is because the Germans were not a threat to the Romans that would require such elaborate defenses. Now, part of this is because the Germans were seen as inferior to the Romans. We've already discussed how they thought nothing about the northern frontier. Their worries were to the east or internal. But another reason why the stone forts were unnecessary for the Germans was simply that forts were not going to fit into a war with German tribes. Your fort's job was to secure a border territory from a hostile takeover and slow down a large threat from moving deeper into your empire until you could gather enough troops and counter it. That's what the fort's job was supposed to do. A stone-walled fort is made with the big threats in mind, something that could easily take down a wooden palisade. The Germans were not these big threats. As a tribe, they weren't going to be big enough to mount a successful assault on a palisade, let alone a stone fort. And they also did not have any siege weapons of any sort that could knock down a palisade wall, let alone a stone wall. The other issue for the reason why Germans are just not going to fight forts is because it's not built into the heart of German warfare. The Germans always look to attack weak targets. They're looking for riches, for something they can quickly grab and get out. A fort is not going to fit into that priority. And the Germans who've attempted to attack forts in the past have always been plagued by the fact that their warriors simply don't want to do it. And so a fort of any kind, whether it be earthen, wooden, or stone, would be deterrent enough for the Germans to avoid it. And so why waste your money building elaborate stone forts when a simple wooden wall would do the same thing? Now, you're probably thinking, all right, you know what? Even with wooden forts, they can be on high alert. They can be watching the Rhine. They can be making sure those Germans stay in their place. But it's not like that. The Romans don't have this elaborate line of defenses, even if it is made from wood, going up and down the entire frontier. It's not the Western Front of World War I. What you could expect from the Roman Empire's defenses was a fort here, an observation tower connecting it to another one, and then another fort, and then maybe one, two, or three more towers between that and the next fort, and so forth. These towers would be about 500 meters down the line from one another, so they do have observation. They do see what the Germans are doing, and hopefully be able to stop raiders. But they don't have elaborate defenses. They don't have a giant wall built up. They just have a couple of wooden forts and some towers in between them. The majority of these defenses, by the way, were woefully undermanned, despite the fact that they were supposed to have 8 legions positioned along the Rhine and the Danube. These troops, however, were spread very thin. Got to remember, this is an extremely long border, going all the way from modern-day Netherlands down to southern Bavaria, all the way over to eventually the Black Sea. That's a lot of ground for the Romans to cover. Now, what these soldiers would be doing is standing guard, keeping a list of who's coming in and out of the empire, checking to make sure that no large groups are coming across. Eventually, they'll try to regulate some trade with the Germans. And some basic maintenance. Now, the maintenance wouldn't be much. Mainly, it would just be keeping the path clear from the forts to the towers, all the way to the next fort, of course, and then maintaining the towers and the forts themselves. Basic stuff. Probably very boring most of the time. On top of that, if you're located on the Rhine, it was probably one of the most boring of the defenses that you had to deal with because, well, there were more threats on the Danube, at least in the Romans' eyes. Occasionally, you'd have to fight some raiders. Occasionally, you'd have to go chase some people down. But for a while, yeah, the Rhine's kind of boring. So that's the frontier. This is the border that's supposed to separate the empire from the barbarians, from those uncultured swine, from those people who don't wear togas, you know, those guys, right? What about the Romans who decide to live on this border? What could they expect? And by this point, not just the Romans, but the Gauls. Well, at first, you're not going to be expecting too much from a civilian population along the frontier. This is going to take some time. Part of the reason is because it had taken the Romans a little while to get comfortable in the area. Remember, they just got pushed out of Germania. A lot of them lost their families, lost their lifestyles, lost everything when the Romans were kicked out. So might take a while before people feel comfortable enough to actually go back and settle near the border. Eventually, though, the lure of Roman soldiers' money is just going to be too much for merchants to ignore. And they're going to move in and they're going to establish themselves. And you're going to have merchants of all kind who are just going to be coming to get all the Roman soldiers' money who are stuck on the border and are probably rather bored. Soon these merchants are going to be followed by their own families, and then by the soldiers' girlfriends and families and wives. And then suddenly, these small stations that have been building up around these forts become small towns. Eventually, into cities themselves. In total, 12 of these Roman cities still exist in Germany today. But at the time, they don't have much in connection with the German tribes across the border, across the frontier. They have more in relationship with Gaul, with Rome, than they do with the German tribes. For instance, take Caen, which was the capital of the Gallic Empire during the late 200s AD. This is a German town, yet it's serving as the capital for an empire of Gaul. These centuries apart from the Germanic tribes do actually play a significant role in its cultural and linguistic changes within the region, and we can talk about that in a different episode. Overall, these cities would range from small to medium size, and they would never really reach the glory or the spectacle of the Mediterranean cities. Just didn't have that influence, that population, that wealth. What they would serve as would be centers of economic and political importance within the Western Empire, specifically when it came with dealing with the northern tribes. Now, I did mention that, you know, they don't have much in relationship with the German tribes, and they had a lot in relationship with the cities you would find in Gaul and Rome. However, that's not 100% true, because these cities would have some Germanic tribes living in them or visiting them a lot more than you would find in Gaul or Rome, which would play a slight difference in the city. And so we do see some changes. For instance, we do find in some of the cities old gods, gods that aren't of the Romans, forming actual centers of worship in this area, thanks to the role of the German warriors and tribesmen who are coming to the city, who are being able to influence the people that live there. These towns could expect these populations just because the frontier wasn't that heavily regulated or guarded. Basically, the only thing that wasn't allowed across the frontier was large movement of people. Most of the tribes would be kept on the far side, with very few exceptions. But single people, merchants, they could cross the border with ease. For the Germans coming to these towns, they could be getting a taste of Roman society, Roman culture in these border towns. And they could also get access to goods of the empire that they definitely can't get at home. The trade actually booms quite well. For instance, during Marcus Aurelius's reign, he will regularize places and days for trading between the Marcomanni and the frontier provinces, partly because so much trade has been going on in the area. The Roman government was worried that too much wealth was being drained out of the region and going to the Marcomanni, who Marcus Aurelius does not have the best of relationship with. So the Germans could come to these towns and they could trade. The Romans could leave the towns, they could cross the frontier, and there they would be establishing relationships with tribes, doing trade, bringing the goods to the Germans so they could see what was available to them. Or, in some cases, just simply making a name for themselves, exploring the great beyond that had halted the famous Drusus, that had stumped the Emperor Tiberius, that had actually held off the Romans. We're told of one such knight during the reign of Nero, who went all the way up to the Baltic and brought back with him some amber. He had done this in order to honor the emperor at the games, but also, and this is probably more important to him, to show how brave he was, how daring he was to go so far into the unknown and the uncivilized. So that's what the Romans are doing on their frontier. That's what the frontier looks like. What's going on the other side? What are the Germans up to? Well, we talked about how Germania was in this massive upheaval thanks to the war with Rome. Many of the tribes had been decimated, their lands burned to the ground, some of them losing their land permanently. So there was a lot of things going on. We saw some political upheaval where the Marcomanni lose their king and their control of the region with the death of Marbutus. And in the west with Arminius, who, after trying to unite the Germans under his control, ended up dying by their hands. This upheaval for Germany actually plays in Rome's favor for the next 200 years. The German tribes will fight among one another for the usual reasons of old enemies, for old claims, and, of course, for better land, rather than focus on the Romans. Now, this will eventually change after the next 200 years, but for now, it's working, and the Romans don't see any reason why to change that. In fact, they're going to encourage it. They will play into it, try to keep the tribes constantly fighting one another. Many of these tribes that were located on the border will be paid by the Romans to be their barrier and eyes and ears for any threats coming towards the border. Again, just like what the Roman Republic used to do. Other tribes, leaders, and even just some warriors would be hired to fight other German tribes considered to be a possible threat to the Romans. We got to remember, the Romans have never forgotten Arminius or Marbutus. And so they're always keeping an eye out on the German tribes, just to make sure there's no one out there who could unite the tribes against them. And if someone starts to rise up, well, you hire some of your loyal tribes to go out there and deal with them. However, Rome's involvement in Germany meant things were going to change. First, we can look at trade in order to see some of the changes that are going on. We have Roman goods throughout Germany, and even further from Germany in Scandinavia, Russia, and Ukraine, all from Rome. And many of these goods would have been sent to the tribes near the Rhine, and then eventually to the Western Baltic, where they would be redistributed from there. As we stated, Germany was extremely poor, so trade was typically lopsided, with the Germans providing lumber, maybe some animal products such as lard for women's hair products, amber, and probably their most important resource, manpower. This manpower, by the way, would be used as auxiliary forces for the army, which we saw under Augustus, slaves for labor, and of course, slaves for entertainment. But that's all the Germans really could offer the Romans. The Romans could offer pretty much anything from the Mediterranean, from Britain, from Gaul. Whatever they wanted, they could give to the Germans. The merchants would be only from the Romans. The Germans would not have any merchants of their own, but would rather have nobles and chiefs of the tribes that the merchants would be meeting with. Making this trade a little bit more political than usual. This would also mean that the merchant class, which usually would get rich, is now the noble class, which is going to get really rich. And it's going to change quite a few things for the Germans. This culmination of the wealth to the nobles meant that they could have more power, more political influence. They could gather more warriors to support themselves. Eventually, because of this, those who had enough wealth, those who had enough warriors, they would consolidate the tribes into larger and larger organizations. Eventually to where they reach their peak, and they realize that they're running low on funds and you need to find a way to get more and more wealth for their very, very large armies. Now, we've been able to find goods in about 500 hordes scattered throughout the northern lands. And it's believed that a portion of this is coming from trade. However, quite a bit of this is not coming from trade, but coming from Roman diplomacy. It is also believed that these 500 hordes just represent a slim amount of the money in the territory. It's believed that overall, there have been millions and millions of Roman coins and goods flowing in and around Germany. Looking at these hordes, the only coinage that we see a rather lack of is from the 180s, around the reign of Commodus, due to the war raging between Commodus and the Marcomanni, and also due to the fact that there was a reduction in value of coins at that time. Most of these coins that we found are silver, not gold, and gold, in fact, really doesn't become popular until the 3rd century. But these are thousands of coins that we found, representing millions of coins out there. And also we have found others that are simply no way it could be with trade. These are amazing, beautiful vases that show the history of Hercules. These are beautiful cauldrons and masks that clearly show a political relationship between whoever laid it here and Rome. Now, I do say whoever laid it here in Rome, but that's not technically true, because the Germans didn't always hold on to what the Romans gave them. Many of these items would actually be taken by the Germans and turn around and be used to further their own diplomatic relationship with other tribes. Or, as it would become more common down the road, to pay off their warriors. This massive amount of wealth that's being flown through Germany, of course, changes these tribes. We already talked about how they become these large organizations. But it also changes certain facts. But it also changes certain aspects of their culture. For instance, we see a change in the weapons of the Germans, specifically their swords. Their swords suddenly start switching to the gladius, to the Roman sword. I'm not talking about them just finding a Roman soldier and taking their sword from them, but actually producing their own version of it. These changes really become pronounced in the early 100s AD when we have evidence of Germans producing these swords in workshops from the Elbe to the Scandinavia. In workshops from the Elbe to Scandinavia. These swords were light, they were quick, and though they may not have been as good quality as the Romans, because the Germans don't have access to the same materials, they were still very sturdy and very effective. Now, many of these weapons were made to be copies of the ones that they captured from the Romans during the wars with Arminius. Very few of these would actually be gifts from the Romans. In fact, it would be surprising if the Romans were giving out weapons to the Germans. So their society is changing. They're adapting to some of the Roman styles. They are keeping their own. We don't see a large adaptation of the Roman gods. We don't see an adaptation of their building, of any of their styles of clothing, anything like that we don't see. What we see is a lot of wealth. What we see is an adaptation of their military arms and a slight changing in their military tactics. And more importantly, we see a unifying of the tribes. The final change I want to talk about for the Germans in this new frontier is something that would not have been easily traced by the Germans or the Romans, because it is a process over a long time. I'm talking about from generation to generation. Germania was a land of transition. It was not a land of permanent settlement. The tribes in the east are hunter-gatherers that were used to moving from place to place, and Germany was where they would eventually migrate, either due to being kicked out of their own lands or in search of loot. But they eventually migrate here, kick out whoever was there, and start to adapt into a more of an agricultural style. Eventually, they would get kicked out of their lands, and they would move westwards into Gaul, which would gain them access to the wealth in the trade of the Mediterranean. Now, this process, I've mentioned before, was something that had been going on for centuries. Even before the Romans had even colonized Rome, this process had been going on. The Gauls had once lived in Germany, and the Germanic tribes would have eventually pushed them out of Gaul itself, or caused a hybrid between the two cultures to be formed, had Rome not intervened. It was like a river flowing towards the ocean. And Rome's intervention is a dam that's been placed to stop this flow, to stop this natural cycle. Now, at first, it doesn't change too much. At least, nothing too noticeable. The German tribes are too weak. They've been fighting for a long time with one another and the Romans. It's going to be a while before they can build up to be strong enough to take on the Romans again. But starting in the 2nd century, a rapid change starts to build up as the German tribes are now having to deal with new threats in the east. And these new mega tribes will have to make some very tough decisions. The dam had worked for a while. The river had stopped flowing, but now it was coming over the edge. And for the Germans, they were either going to have to break the dam or be squeezed between the new threat to the east and the Romans to the west and be eliminated altogether. And as such, we'll start seeing an increase in aggressive moves, in attacks, and threats along the Rhine and the Danube, starting in the late 2nd century and building up to an eventual outbreak into Roman territories. Roman territories that were busy looking inward at civil wars, at threats of an Eastern superpower, at the collapse of their own government, rather than the building pressure to the north. All right, that will do it for this episode. Next episode, we'll look at the very few things that we do have to talk about from the sources. From the first century to the breakdown of the Rhine border. I know, this is kind of surprising that we're covering so many centuries in the span of two episodes. We spent about half the show in dealing with less than 90 years, but that is how the sources have panned out. Don't worry, we'll eventually be back to diving in deep again when the Romans wake up to what is no longer being held beyond the northern frontier. Until then, have a great day, and I will see you in 2 weeks.